You're listening to Desi Dilemmas on Pod Bazaar. We'll be back after this quick message.
This show is brought to you by podbazaar.com, the one-stop shop for podcast listeners, publishers, and advertisers. Have a craving for Desi programs? Simply browse through our library of podcasts in different languages from the South Asian region, and you have your own personalized radio station at your fingertips. Find and listen to your favorite shows at www.podbazaar.com. That's podbazaar.com.
Welcome back to Desi Dilemmas, where we put the everyday issues of Desis everywhere into a broader picture. I'm Smitha, and I'll be sharing with you some analysis, some anecdotes, and an interesting interview. Thank you so much for joining me today to kick off our new series. Today we kick off a new series that attempts to revisit the Desi obsession with the identity crisis, broadly defined. Google tells me that the term identity crisis, at least in the mainstream world, refers to one of two things. There's the title of a recent, highly acclaimed comic book series about superheroes coming together to solve a murder, on one hand, or, on the other hand, the psychologist Erik Erikson's famous term, identity crisis, which Erikson believed was a critical developmental stage, usually dealt with in the teenage years. Erikson said that how one deals with this critical stage sets up one's adult life, and that identity crises can be recurring, depending both on internal and external changes. That assessment rang some bells from some long-forgotten psychology courses in college for me. Now, for me as a South Asian American, the identity crisis was the term that started to populate the youth pages of the India West newspaper in the early to mid-1990s. It was a scary thing to be avoided at all costs, something that we bicultural folks were particularly susceptible to. In these writings, it seemed like it was something that might have even been unique to being Desi, something that other people with less tenuous cultural makeups didn't really have to worry about. In retrospect, that seems unlikely. If Erikson was worth his salt, then the idea of an identity crisis is a generic one that is more common than unusual, something to be embraced and navigated with courage, not something to avoid and deny with fear. As we grew up, it became clear to those of us who were supposed to be having these crises that everyone has them in some form or another. If it's not cultural, then it's something else. So in this series, we'll be examining not so much what identity crises look like or who has them or how they overcome them, but rather to take a good look at what they're made out of. Is there really such a thing as a culture clash? Where does the idea come from and how do each of us play a role in it? Does something good come out of the so-called clash? What does that look like? Meet Chandini Davis, a San Francisco student with a fresh perspective on these issues.
There is definitely the divide between the Indians and the halves. And me, like, I don't know, I think I look it. I think I look Indian enough. I have my nose ring, I have my bangles, I have my rings. But no matter, I could be speaking Hindi, eating a samosa, riding an elephant, and people would be like, oh, you're Indian? I think I'm pretty well-balanced. American-born confused Desi, but people are confused about me. I'm not confused about me.
Today we'll listen in on Chandini's experiences and dreams and think about what her story can tell us about religion, Indianness, and race in the U.S. today. Stay tuned. It's funny. Living at the nexus of two worlds used to seem like an oddity, but somehow, and maybe this is purely from my own experience, but it seems like everyone is in between two or more worlds in some way or another these days. How often is it that everything in the world is consistent with everything else? I first realized this during what was perhaps the most vivid semester of my college experience, a semester during which I lived in Jodhpur, Rajasthan, within the walls of the spectacular Mehrangarh Fort with a group of 15 other students. Each scorching afternoon, I would troop down the steep and rocky footpath leading down from the fort to Jodhpur's old blue bazaar, sometimes with friends, sometimes alone. I did it so often that I knew the people whose homes were on the way, and Jodhpur being a friendly sort of a town, we would greet each other. On one such afternoon, I said my smiling namastes to a Bhai Sahib I often spoke to, and paused briefly for a short conversation in Hindi, fending off offers for chai and snacks. As we were talking, a tall white guy with a huge backpack, a tattered Lonely Planet book in his hand, walked by and stopped in front of us. Now, it was pretty common to see tourists in this part of Jodhpur. Most came to Jodhpur only to see the fort. The white guy asked a question about how to get to the fort in European-inflected English. I responded. The guy was stunned. He just didn't know what to make out of an American voice coming out of a salwar-clad figure. He didn't expect me to speak English like this. And Bhai Sahib was just thrilled that I had been able to assist. But the white guy just couldn't leave the exchange at that. "Where are you from?" he asked. I tried to explain that I was a student living in Jodhpur, that I spoke a bit of Hindi, that my parents were from India. In retrospect, I have no idea why I felt so compelled to give this complete stranger so much information. "But what does your passport say?" he wanted to know. "I have an American passport." "Well then, you're American. Why make it more complicated than that? You check your passport, and that's it. I'm Dutch, my father's Italian, but that doesn't matter. I'm Dutch, it's that simple. But it's certainly lucky for you that you look Indian. Must be much easier to get along here. The other day there was a white woman traveling alone. Did you hear about this? She got raped on a train. You wouldn't have these kinds of problems." I tried to explain, but it was hopeless. This man could not and would not understand. Bhai Sahib, who had caught on to some of this conversation, tried to tell him that, "Look, she's Indian. See her clothes. See how she talks. She's one of us." But the white guy had made up his mind, and the exchange replayed in my mind for days, weeks, because I knew it could never be that simple for me. And not only could it not be that simple, I wanted other people to know that it wasn't that simple. I just wasn't willing to accept others believing exactly what they wanted about me. I felt I had to explain, make a point. What happens when people believe you to be something different than what you believe yourself to be? Do you fight it? Do you prove yourself? Or do you accept it? What does it do to you? And even more importantly, what does it do to everyone else? The thing is, when it comes to things like being Indian, being American, it's quite amazing how much stock we put into things like physical appearance, accent, dress, style. When it comes down to it, I don't think any of us would say that our cultural identities come from any of those things, yet we put an unreal amount of faith in these bizarre markers. Chandani is a particularly interesting example of this dilemma. Listen to Chandani talk about the dynamics of her Hinduism class in San Francisco. How what is Indian and how what is Hindu get merged together, and how, even though she feels both Indian and Hindu, with the knowledge and history to back it up, doesn't get to be a part of it.
So my Hinduism class, there's a huge difficulty because I'm the half Indian. And I happen to know a lot about the Hinduism because my dad is, like, totally into the Vedas, and my mom is too. So this has been, like, ingrained in me since I was little. I practice it. I'm very into it. So in class, like, there's, like, four or five Indian kids in it who are, like, straight Indian. Two Indian parents, very, like, they all speak fluently. They put out this image of being Indian that's maybe just specific to their family. And the kids in our class think that that's all Indians or that's all Hinduism. For me being in that class, I'm like, that's not being a Hindu. That's not it. That's being maybe your family in America, but that's not representative of our whole culture. And there's this, like, whole play between me and them because they have to, like, outshow me. They have this whole, like, competition. They have to prove it because they, like, look Indian and, you know, I don't look Indian enough, I guess. Anytime I say something in class, they have to raise their hand and either agree with it or counter it to validate that, yeah, okay, we know that too. They just don't see me as being Indian. Like, they just don't see it, no matter how, like, Hindu I am.
Perhaps the thing that distinguishes Chandani from many of her peers with two Indian parents is that Chandani just doesn't have the angst about being bicultural that many Indian Americans have. It sits well with her. It feels natural to her.
I'm Indian a lot.
because it flows very naturally for me. You know, it's easy enough for me to wear my kurta or, you know, not eat my meat, yeah. Go to temple. Yeah. Very easy. Yeah. Like, I just treat it as, you know, anything else.
And while Desis who move back to the motherland these days scour the crazy real estate markets for posh single-family homes in Bangalore suburbs, Chandini is planning out another kind of India dream on the banks of the Narmada.
I really want to, this is totally a pipe dream, but I want to have a tea plantation. Yeah, and like live in the, up in the middle of nowhere. No, I just like, I love the idea of like getting back to the land and like just growing and just being free. Because my extended family, we're from Nagpur in Maharashtra. They all have farms. Yeah, but they have orange and wheat and, because Nagpur's famous for its oranges. I've always wanted to be a farmer since I was little.
Chatting with Chandini for an hour made me re-examine my own knee-jerk reactions. It's not that I had trouble accepting or understanding all the ways in which Chandini feels profoundly Hindu, feels profoundly Indian. It's just that I kept waiting for her to tell me about her angst. But really, she didn't have any. Sure, she's a bit annoyed that her Indian-American peers just can't seem to accept her as one of them, but other than that, the only thing striking about Chandini as an Indian-American is her lack of issues about being Indian-American herself. There could be real reasons for this. If you walked by Chandini on the streets of San Francisco, you probably would not wonder whether she was Desi or not. Chandini did not recount tales of feeling left out at a white elementary school or feeling weird about foreign foods in her lunchbox. Now, maybe she experienced these things and she's just an extraordinarily secure person, or maybe she didn't have to because she happened to look more like her peers. In the U.S., racial cues still matter. In India, as Chandini pointed out, however, they don't seem to matter as much. At least, people take her at face value. They never question her Indianness. Chandini speaks some Hindi and knows more about Hinduism, Vedic astrology, and the banks of the Narmada than almost any other Indian American that I've met. But then, maybe that's not what her Indian American peers are looking for.
I'm, in a sense, more traditional than they are. Because I'm not close to the idea of an arranged marriage. I'm not close to it at all. I used to be less open to it. But now, as I'm getting older and as I'm realizing what I want in my life, I'm totally open to it. So, yeah, and so in this way, like, I'm more traditional than half of these, you know, quote-unquote Indian kids, the true Indians. And I don't know if that scares them or not. I don't know if they're like, oh, she's trying too hard. Which I'm not. I'm not trying anything. I'm just living my life.
What do we look for when we seek community? If it were as simple as a common culture, then none of us would be in any sort of crisis ever because cultures stretch so wide, so broad, they get fragmented and reinvented and expanded in every individual. But we're not ready for that, I don't think. I have a feeling that the second generation Indian Americans, we haven't really figured out what community means, not really. We're still stuck somehow, stuck trying to figure out who's in and who's not, still trying to explain ourselves to the world when that explanation only matters to ourselves.
And I just always wonder, like, why leave people out? Like, it doesn't make sense. We're all from the same country. We're all Desis, right?
Since that day at the base of Mehrangarh, I've decided that it's just fine to be a bit of a cultural chameleon. I'm okay with allowing people to assume whatever they want about me. I don't try to talk to white Americans when I see them in India anymore. If they see me as part of the native scenery, I'm okay with that. In other words, the Jodhpur incident wouldn't bother me much if it happened today. Authenticity. What kind of authenticity? What does it mean? What happens when you get authenticated? Scholars have contemplated this issue so much in such obscure language that it seems crazy to go through all of that here. In some ways, though, because Chandini's racial appearance doesn't force her to be brown, Chandini gets to authenticate herself, though she may not get recognized as the real deal in some cases, in the U.S., that is. Now, those of us who are brown in the U.S. are faced with a similar set of issues in reverse, being forced to represent a culture, a place, a people, before you've even had a chance to decide whether it's yours. And all those dynamics get shaken up every time you cross that international dateline. So what do you root for? Forget about figuring out what is authentically Indian and just all be authentic people, revel in our multiplicity, our vexed identities? It's a nice idea, maybe, but do we even know what that would look like? I certainly don't. the weight of a heavy past of nations, cultures, races, differences, clearly demarcated, lives through us each day. I like this quote by Toni Morrison. She's talking about race, but it's the same with cultures, I think. Cultural and racial differences raise the same sorts of questions about inclusion and exclusion. Morrison writes, "These questions which have engaged so many have troubled all of my work. How to be free and situated, how to convert a racist house into a race-specific yet non-racist home, how to enunciate race while depriving it of its lethal cling." I don't think we know how to answer these questions yet, but hopefully us bicultural, tricultural, multiply migrated folks will keep the discussion going. That's it for this episode of Desi Dilemmas. Join me next time when we'll continue discussing who gets to be Indian in the context of music and dance in the U.S., who gets to represent the motherland in cultural representations. Until then, I hope you'll write to me with comments and questions and suggestions for this series, which is still very much in formation. DesiDilemmas@yahoo.com. If you enjoy the music on this show, check out the music of Vidya, led by Carnatic saxophonist Prashant Radhakrishnan. Vidya will be playing at Artvala, the South Asian American Arts Festival in Los Angeles, on June 24th, so be sure to catch them there if you're in the area. Thanks a million for listening, and see you next time. This show is hosted by PodBazaar.com.